Hi, I'm Amy Nelson.
And I'm Sam Edis.
Welcome to our very first episode of What's Her Story with Sam and Amy. Sam, it's finally here.
It's hard to believe, but since the moment we met, you and I have been obsessed with talking. We've been in an endless conversation, and we love hearing each other's stories and the stories of women who are busy as heck and just doing it all. And between the two of us, we have 7 children, not together. And we're both entrepreneurs and founders, and we're always busy, but we definitely both have a pretty optimistic outlook on life.
I think the reason we've really bonded as friends over the past few years, and it was a fast friendship. Sam and I were going through a bunch of pictures and we're like, how have we spent this much time together when you live in LA and I live in Seattle and we both have kids and companies, but we have made it work and we have lots of fun pictures to share. But I think the reason have bonded over these past few years is that we both live a big life. We are people who want to take chances, who will go for the hardest thing, and who will never take no for an answer, which is something we talk to a lot of our guests about because they are the same.
It's so funny hearing you say that because we never take no for an answer, but we always say yes ourselves. So I think that's part of how we have a big life is you and I'll be like, sure, I'll hop in a plane and go to that amazing opportunity and see what happens. Or let's plan that dinner party, even though we're going to be exhausted and having worked an 18-hour day. Like you and I are both always saying yes, which is why it's so hard for us to accept no from other people.
Exactly. I agree. And it's so funny. One of the reasons I know we always say yes is half the pictures that we have together. I am like massively pregnant with one of my 4 daughters. And I always think, how did I have the energy to do that? Because in this upside down world we're living in now, it's sometimes that energy is hard to find. But what we want to do on this show is bring you these stories of women who are out there doing these things, not taking no, and just building things that seem probably impossible to most people.
And they each have a story of overcoming so much. I think from the outside, it's so easy to say, oh, they got lucky or that success happened so fast. But I really never seen a story of success that happened overnight. You know, you work hard to position yourself for good things to happen. And if you're not working hard, it's really hard to have success. And I know you feel the same way as I do, but like each of these women inspires me so differently. And they're all at the top of their field, whether it's medicine or media, they all have that one thing in common, which is that they have just persevered. They've had this incredible journey. And I feel like it's our job, Amy, to tease that story out of them.
I think it is. And I do think we do a good job of it, I have to say. You know, one thing that you and I have talked about over the years is that we don't get to hear women's stories a lot. We know all these things about these like titans of industry that are men, right? Like we know that Jeff Bezos makes pancakes for breakfast. I'm not sure if I believe that, but I read it somewhere. We know about like Mark Cuban's leadership traits and all of these things. But what about the women who are out there doing big things? We don't get to hear their stories. And I think the thing that we do differently is that we also understand that your personal story and your professional story cannot be separated. They are one in the same. One influences the other, and it makes you the whole of who you are.
I don't even know how you would tell these stories without including the personal journey. And I feel that way whether it's a man or a woman that is being interviewed. I want to know what it was like in their house that morning before they got to the board meeting. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of those things matter. If you think about it, our kids range in age from 0 to 14. Yeah. So as working parents, we really understand what you're going through. And if you are single, if you have a goldfish, if you have a dog, if you have 15 kids, we understand you because we're women and we love hearing women's stories. And we hope that in each episode, you are going to find some inspiration, whether it's personal inspiration or professional inspiration, but it's going to make you want to live a bigger life. Now let's talk about this episode.
Okay, our very first episode begins with a life-changing moment that Glennon Doyle, who is the best-selling author of Untamed, Hero to Mothers Everywhere, you know her, when Glennon met Abby Wambach, the Olympic legend, pay equity champion. They met in the back room of a book tour. The story gives us goosebumps.
I was in Chicago at the Palmer House about to launch Love Warrior. It was the first ever public event for Love Warrior, which was a book about, that was being, the tagline of the book was epic marriage redemption story. Okay, so it was the book about my first marriage, recovering from infidelity in the marriage, and how we made it through. Okay, so that was great. So I was at the Palmer House for that. And I was sitting around a table with a bunch of other writers who were all also launching books, because it was this big event for all a bunch of writers who were putting out memoirs in the fall. And there was this weird moment where all the talking at the table stopped and everyone looked at the door. So I looked over at the door and there was this human standing in the doorway, and she was like 12,000 feet tall.
5'11",
same. And she was wearing this like dark gray trench coat and this red blood scarf. And she was like, just this platinum crazy hair, like shaved on the side. And she was like, she was like a guy and a girl and like beyond and between. Like, I know I've never seen anything like this. And she had this like, is this so awkward for you sitting right here while I'm telling this story? Yeah. And this like, blue like denim eyes that were like, she's just very cool and warm at the same time. And you have to understand, it wasn't just everyone, all of the writers were just staring at her, because it was like the Mockingjay had arrived at our nerdy book party, right? We were just like, this person is too cool to be in this room with us. But everyone else handled their shit a little bit better than I did, because this is what happened next, which has become family folklore. But there's no awkward situation that I can't make more awkward. It's my spiritual gift.
That's true.
Yeah. And so she, if you can imagine like this big table with all of these writers and then Abby standing in the doorway, and I, something in my body, which has never happened before and I never expected to happen again. It was the weirdest moment of my life. Just everything in me was like, there she is. Like just an absolute and total recognizing, even though I'd never seen her before, but it was not a meeting. It was a recognizing. So the there she is moment happens, and then suddenly I come to consciousness and I'm standing up like this at the table with my arms thrown open towards the door like this, okay? I know. So now I'm noticing that everyone at the table is staring at me, and I have to figure out how to get from this position back to my chair. So what I decided to do is to just bow deeply and just hope that everyone thought, well, this is just her weird writer's thing. She just bows when people walk in the door. So I bowed and then just sat back down like this.
Did you know that Abby was Abby Wambach, the greatest soccer player of all time?
I knew that. So we had information about who was going to be there. So I knew there was a Sporty Spice type person coming, right? And like, it was like, if one of these things are not like the other, like she was definitely the Sporty Spice person. That was clear. Right. And I knew that she was Abby, and I knew that she was a soccer player, and I knew that she was kind of a big deal. But a lot of the people, I mean, the people in the room were like George Saunders and Terry McMillan. There was a lot of big deals in the room. Right. So, yeah. So what about you?
And from my perspective, I walk in, I'm a little bit late, which is very uncommon. I hate being late for stuff. Mm-hmm. And I walk in and I notice everybody's there, and I look up and this weird woman is standing up, arms stretched out. And so because of her awkwardness, I now have to find my way around the whole table, because nobody else stood up, just Glennon. And I had to, you know, and this is not like a huge room by any means. There's not like tons of space between the back of the chairs. So I've got to like sidestep my way around the table. And I finally get to Glennon and I was like,
hi.
Hi, you know? And then I sat down in my seat and we weren't seated next to each other. But I just remember being like, that was very, very interesting. Odd even. And then I kept feeling throughout the whole dinner, I was next to this children's book writer, feeling like, well, I want to sit next to her for some reason. Why do I want to sit next to her? This is weird. And then after dinner, we had to walk to the stage where the actual event was taking place. And in the literally 3 minutes it took us to get from the back room dinner table to the stage, I kind of told Glennon my whole story, and she like touched my arm, and for sure that was like a lightning bolt for me. That shocked me. I wasn't like consciously aware of it. I think my heart and my soul knew way sooner than my brain. And then I heard her spoke, and she made me laugh and cry and laugh again and cry again. Hearing her talk so truthfully about her former marriage, her book Love Warrior, and I don't
addiction. Know. We talked a lot about addiction. And,
yeah.
It was.
But at the time, it was about your current marriage. So, were you aware when you were talking? Like, did you kind of change the speech a little because Abby was in the room?
Oh, Samantha, so interesting you asked. No one has ever asked me that question in my 49,000 interviews about both of these books. But in fact, I did change my whole speech. My speech that was largely about my marriage redemption became something different in the moment. It was largely just about all the things that I would think that would make Abby think I was cool.
So
it was good though. So it was a great speech.
It really was. And so to be clear, I went back to my room that night, and she had given me a copy of Love Warrior, and I read it from cover to cover that night, which I'm a very slow reader, and I would rather listen to a book on tape than read it. So it was like I was very dedicated. And then when I got to the end of this book, she didn't really talk about like the redemptive part of it in her speech. So I was a little bit like, what? This is not right.
This is not how the story ends.
No, I was very shocked. And so when I got an email from her, you know, days later,
which I emailed to her person, her agent person who was with her. Yeah. I didn't email it to her.
I got an email from her a few days later. I thought, okay, well, we're just going to be friends, you know, and that didn't last. So.
I think one of the most startling things is that you had never touched, you'd never been on a date, and you broke up your marriage without even having experience. Oh my gosh, what if we were not like connected? I mean, was there a fear like, what if this isn't what I think it's gonna be?
Yeah, it didn't matter though, because it was not just like a love story. It was not just like, oh, am I gonna stay in this marriage or marry Abby? It was very clear to me after meeting, after having discussions on email, after it was a reckoning with myself. It was like, oh, I'm just pretending this thing is something that it's not anymore. And like, it was really, you know, that there she is moment. It was like hearing from a part of myself that I had buried so long ago. And the there she is, I think of as me. I don't think of it even as Abby anymore. Like the there she is was like, oh, hi, this is the self that I've been burying forever and pretending that things are good enough and pretending that this is a life and pretending that this is a marriage. And it was really about, it wasn't, am I gonna love Craig or Abby? It was, am I gonna abandon myself? Or am I gonna abandon the whole world's expectations of me and just leave this? So it wasn't like I'm leaving because I know this is gonna work out. We'd never spent 10 minutes alone together. It was, I'm gonna leave because I can't pretend anymore, regardless of whether this works.
And that basis, that argument, like, I love that. But like, sometimes I think about it now, and it was the only thing that made sense at the time. Mm-hmm. Like thinking back on it now, I'm like, we were probably literally insane. Like our brains
were
so lit up that we couldn't make the right decisions based on external expectations, right? We were only operating on like a soul level, mm-hmm. on like a what we knew, what the most beautiful and true life we could imagine, like it was for sure. So it's like, you know, scientists would say, you know, your brain lights up in certain ways that your prefrontal cortex actually is able of making certain decisions.
When you fall in love. Mm-hmm.
When you fall in love or when you're on drugs, like all
same.
But the truth is like, I think it's even deeper than that for us it was like a recognizing or a remembering. Like when you walked, when I walked in that door and we fell in love, it was like, oh, this, you know, because I had up until this point have been such a hopeless romantic.
Yes, she was.
And she was, she's never believed in love a day in her life, right? So for me, I always kind of knew that this was possible, that this person was out there. And Glennon was like, that's just horseshit. Like you, all your romantics can go straight to you know where. But the at the end of it, I'm so glad that we didn't listen to the world's expectations of what we should have done in that moment, because I truly do know, and it wasn't easy by any means, it was worth it.
Yeah, and it was a little just, I think in life you just get a few slices of magic, you know? There's just, if you believe in anything beyond like the everyday mundane of like, here we go, and we're doing this life we're supposed to do, it's like every once in a while magic cuts through. And I think like that was a moment where I was just like, oh, if you just don't get many of these moments.
That's so beautiful. And I might cry. But you know, like in talking about this, you both have made so many big, public, huge decisions over the past decade, right? Like starting businesses, leaving marriages, becoming parents. What do you, you know, you talked about this decision and it was such a big one, but like generally, what goes into making a decision for you? Do you make decisions quickly? Do you take time?
This is really good question for us because we're very different.
Mm-hmm. How would you say you make decisions?
I'm a gut decisioner, decision maker, and you are a research taker, poll taker, time meeting.
I've talked a lot about this with my team. When we were going through this decision-making process about our marriage, about our relationship, about the marriage, about when to go public, about what to sell, all of it. Because, you know, deciding to leave my marriage 6 weeks before Love Warrior was launched was not, it was
a frowned upon.
Like the amount of people whose careers like were affected by that decision. It was an open book club pick at that point. Like, Oprah was involved in deciding. Like it was so, I mean, I was announcing a divorce and a relationship with Abby to in the middle of launching a marriage redemption book to a largely Christian faith-based audience. Like there was nobody that was involved in my career who wasn't like, besides my sister, really, who wasn't like, this is career suicide.
What did Oprah say?
Well, I'll tell you.
This is really good.
So the idea was from all the agents, from all the editors, from everyone involved that if I did this, it was over. That like, this was it. Nobody was going to buy this book, that the book was over, that my career was over, that it would be a bloodbath, that the world was not ready for this. And my community was not ready for this. And it would be. So they were trying to all get me to not tell the story. To just go on the road, launch the book, and not tell. And they kept saying it in different ways that made it seem like it wasn't lying, but at the end of the day, it kept being lying. Okay? So.
We're not going to just tell them, we're not going to say anything. We're going to.
It's just privacy. It's not secrecy. It's just, you know, all of these mental gymnastics. And so one night I was going to bed and I was thinking, God, they're all trying to be the boss of me. And then I was like, oh, I remember who the boss of the world is. So the next day I called Oprah. And I said so many things. I told her all the things, but I also said, I just feel like the right thing to do is to tell the truth and just let the chips fall wherever they're gonna fall, blah, blah, blah. And so she, after saying many brilliant things, said, here's what I've always said in situations like this. What I know to be true is that we always end up with the truth. So let's just start with it. I'm with you. Go out and tell the truth. Of course, her having most invested in this book's success, right? She was the one that was like, yes, let's go tell the truth. So then the best part is the next day, I got to call all the agents and editors and say, so here's the deal. I was talking to Oprah. And then you guys, everybody was like, oh, I too believe in the truth. Yes. Yes. I also was just thinking that yesterday. We start with the truth.
Yeah. So to go way back to the question of decisions, I think that even though Glenn and I's process to come to a decision might be a little different, I think it's all wrapped up in truth, and that has to be like the foundation of whatever decision it is we're making. It can be tile that we're picking up for the bathroom floor or groceries or what to do with kids during this weird time, virtual school, right? Like, however it is we both process through to this specific decision, whatever it is, it has to be true.
True. Yeah.
And it has to feel warm.
We say that a lot. What feels warm, what feels cold, go away from what feels cold, go towards what feels warm. Things that other people would think might be a little crazy, but I actually think are less crazy than a lot of the other ways we make decisions.
Yeah.
Because so much wisdom is in our bodies, you know?
Yeah.
We're taught not to trust ourselves anymore. We're taught to read the books and read the facts and not listen to what's inside you.
And I think that's really, I mean, I do that with my, with we have a team of women who we work with that are our dear, they're our family really. And one of them actually is our family, my sister, but it's this very close knit team of women. And, you know, somewhere along the line, a couple years ago, we were in some kind of meeting and everybody was giving all of their reasons for making their decision, you know, their lists. And I just said, can you just tell me like what, I just want to know, did it feel warm or not? I trust you. The reason you're at this table is because I trust you. And I trust women who trust themselves. So instead of giving me the 4 million stories, you just tell me this is what felt right and I'm with you.
Abby, let's shift gears and talk about your fight for equal pay. Looking back, would you have done anything differently?
That's a good question. So what kind of led me down the path of fighting for equality? I found myself on stage in my retirement. The ESPYs called and they wanted to honor me with what's called the Icon ESPY Award. And if you don't know what the ESPYs are, the ESPYs is a nationally televised show that essentially it's the Oscars for sports and athletes. Every year they give out awards for best athlete, best play, yada, yada, yada. In this specific year, 2016, they wanted to give me the Icon ESPY Award along with two other athletes who were also retiring, Peyton Manning and Kobe Bryant, may he rest in peace. I think you both know those legends, right? Everybody does. And for me, standing on that stage, accepting this award, it was a dream come true, right? It was what you would imagine, book ending, a storied career. I won gold medals. I championed women's sports. I did everything that I thought I was supposed to do, right? And then the lights turned off, the camera shut off, and the three of us walked off stage into very different retirements. So for me, you know, what was supposed to be the night that I was to celebrate my career with the athletes and celebrities, I found myself back in my hotel room wondering how it all happened and what responsibility of mine was the predicament I found myself in. You know, Kobe and Peyton's biggest concern at that point was where they were going to invest their hundreds of millions of dollars that they collectively earned, rightfully so. And my biggest concern was how I was going to pay my mortgage. And, you know, not many people know this, but as a national team player, I fancied myself a little bit. I was a Nike endorsed, Gatorade endorsed athlete. I made okay money, but definitely not money to last for the rest of my life. And so it was a very difficult night, one that I'll never forget, and one that has shaped my retirement in many ways. You know, I promised myself a couple of things that night. One, that I would never let this happen to Alex Morgan, to Megan Rapinoe, or Crystal Dunn, women who are currently playing. I never want them to have that experience walking off that stage. And then knowing that this was happening to me, like I said, I fancy myself. I thought that we national team players rose above, right, all of the discrimination. But I was slapped in the face with the inequity that night and have continued to be since my retirement. And so I've dedicated the rest of my life to making sure that every woman in every industry, in every city, because if this is happening to me, this I know has and is happening to every woman on the planet.
Everybody.
So how much progress has been made in terms of preventing future soccer players from facing that same financial fate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair question. There has been quite a bit of progress that has been made in the history of women's sports. You know, I can't talk about the history without talking about Title IX, which is the 1972 law that was enacted to essentially what it does is any government funded institution has to offer equal treatment to both men and women, girls and boys. And as a byproduct of that, sports was such a big part of that law and how it can affect college sports in particular, right? So I was a beneficiary of that. And then when you think about progress, for me, I want to think about progress for women's sports on a longer scale than women's sports has actually been around, because it's still so new. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing, and you both will understand this and your listeners will very much understand this, when you get into the game late, right? So women's sports is starting later. Many women investors, women founders, women entrepreneurs are coming into the game later. What that means is that there is going to be a taller mountain to climb, right? And when you get into the game, the funds that are given to women are so much smaller at the beginning, right? So when you talk about men's sports, right? We can talk about 1994, the MLS, the Men's Soccer League in the United States. They had a bunch of owners that got together and they collectively raised about $100 million that they knew that they were going to lose before they gained and earned a single penny, before they could actually make it a viable league, right? They had invested and knew that they were going to lose because they were planning on an increased growth, right? For women, we don't ever get that initial mm-hmm. funding. Mm-hmm. We've never gotten that initial funding. So we're starting, right? Like it's that thing where men are starting on third base, right? Women, we're not only in the dugout, but like we're out in the parking lot and having to work our way inside the stadium to even get a shot at a bat, right? So for me, we can talk all day about the inequities, but if we're not actually investing in women early on in the same way that we've invested with men, then there will always be inequity, and always and forevermore.
And people will always say, oh, but it's the market. Like the market demands this for the men, which without even acknowledging that that market that was created by the men.
Like, it was rigged at the beginning. Right?
Yeah.
Sam and I talk about this all the time as founders and talk about investors. So as founders, like women receive only 2% of venture capital funding, meaning that 98% of all dollars invested to startups go to ideas started by men, grown by men. You know, and I have raised for the Riveter almost $30 million, which is like one of the top, I think probably 100 women in the country in terms of fundraising. And I fought for every dollar of it and I've shown good results. And I know so many men that like I was raising a seed round once, my first big round. And I opened the news one day and like these two 24-year-old guys had raised $5 million for a cloud pharmacy for Viagra. And I was like, I want to give up. You know, like this is such bullshit. But the point is you can't. And I want to say truly thank you for fighting a fight where the mountain is harder and higher and you have to keep fighting every single day, because without people like you doing that, none of us will get ahead.
Mm, that's so sweet.
Have you talked to Billie Jean King about her fight?
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, talking about standing on the shoulders of giants, like Billie Jean has been the one who laid so much of the path for the women that I was idolizing in the women's national team. Julie Foudy, Mia Hamm, these women who laid solid ground for me to walk upon one day. Billie Jean laid the bricks, right? And before Billie Jean, I'm sure there were many women who were putting pebbles down. Like everybody has a role, super important. And, you know, quite frankly, what Billie was doing during her time, she was not only fighting for women's rights, but she was also fighting for the LGBTQ community during a time that it was so not accepted. Mm-hmm. So she was fighting these huge battles that, like, you know, under extreme pressure and probably death threats, you know. So for me, being a gay kid, watching her and seeing how she has progressed and seeing how she still is involved in tennis and women's sports, and how she has taken the Women's Sports Foundation and made it such a beautiful enterprise that basically is run and it's an engine of its own, speaks to the kind of passion that is important in starting anything new, right? And you all know what that is like, being an investor or a founder. the people who are running it have to have the idea of it being something more than just earning money. Though I think that that's a virtue in and of itself for women to say, you know what, I want to be rich. I want to have some security. I want to have some power too. Money can do that. Like, I think that that's great. Do I want to also have part in like making the world better? Great. But I'm not going to judge a woman for wanting to be opportunistic and ambitious about wanting to earn her place in the world.
I completely agree. It's so important for women to talk about money, to become financially independent. It's why I started my company, because I saw a lack of opportunities for women to earn financial independence and to earn recurring revenue. And so we train women to sell credit card processing to their local businesses. Like Amy, when I first started raising money, I was so Pollyanna-ish and thought, I'm just going to raise money from women. I'm just going to have women investors. Mm-hmm. And you quickly realize that so few women in our country control money. And it breaks your heart. And even if they do control money, they're not comfortable investing. So men from an early age are taught to take risks and women are taught to save. Look at any women's magazine. It's all about saving money. And it's never about...
Just don't drink your latte. Yeah. Just don't drink your latte. That's how to get power. Just save $4 a week and just deprive yourself more.
Right.
That will crush the patriarchy.
Right. Or marry well. Marry well. You know, that's your best route to wealth. So... you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to both of you about is your relationship with money. You know, many people will say your relationship with money is the longest relationship you'll ever have in your life. Glennon, mm-hmm. I feel like Abby's looking at you. Why?
No,
look, I just talked a lot, so.
Oh, No. It's just so interesting that you're right. I just had a conversation about this morning and I don't know why. Marriage is like one of the places where you figure out what your money story is, right? Like I was raised by two elementary school teachers, public school teachers. And so we had enough, you know, but we never had a lot of extra. And like, for example, I didn't order an appetizer until I was 35. Like I thought that people who ordered appetizers were heathens and like, just obnoxious, you know, like my children would never dream of ordering a Sprite at dinner. Like that is for just Rockefellers, right? Like water is what we have. And so, you know, Abby and I have had so many conversations. I just have a feeling of like, there's not going to be enough. Like there's just not going to be enough. And it was really interesting when we had a conversation once about, okay, so what is then the number that we can stop, that we can just breathe and relax where you're gonna feel like it's enough? Like what's, and we realized that that's not a number. That's like a spiritual feeling of like, do you believe that you're gonna be okay? That like, you're gonna be able to care for yourself, that you're, the universe is gonna care for you, that you are capable of providing for yourself no matter how much there is. So it's just, we have different approaches to money. Like, you know, the simplest term would be like Abby's a spender and I'm a saver, but it's just so much deeper than that.
Was your relationship with money growing up, Abby?
Well, I was the youngest of seven. And so my sisters, the older crew in my family, are definitely more conscious about money. Because as my parents got older, they acquired a little bit more wealth. And I think that because I was very young and formidable at the time, I just always had a feeling of plenty, of having enough of, and you know, we were upper middle class, we weren't rich by any means. And we lived in a small town, so upper middle class is essentially, you have a feeling of plentifulness, right? And I never really wanted for anything, and that has kind of been the essence that I have driven through most of my life, right? I definitely probably could have saved more when I was playing soccer and had a consistent income without having to hustle so much. But I actually have a, I don't have fear around earning money or losing money. I'm definitely, I like to take more risk, in terms of what I want to put our money and how we want to get that invested. But in a marriage, right, the marriage and your financial stability and health and wealth, that's an ever expanding conversation, right? Because your hope is that you can grow your wealth as your marriage gets older and you become a little bit more secure. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how exciting investing is to me from a risk-taking perspective if it makes her terrified.
Well, and it's not just terrified. It's like,
yes, I don't mean to say that you are terrified.
No, it's just complicated. It's complicated. Like, I'm an activist. Most of my day I spend working beside people who are struggling, man. Like, it's not, so it's complicated.
Your activism requires a lot of money to fuel it, right? So it's this tricky thing, because the more money you make and earn, you know you're gonna spend it in a really benevolent way. Mm-hmm. So the more money you invest in your career and in building your wealth, the more people you can help, right? And so it is quite complicated.
Well, and the education piece around financing and finances and investing, you know, for us, and I think that from what I know about you, Glennon, is that you are hell-bent on knowing as much as you possibly can. But like, sometimes when you have to know so much about the world and activism, it, like, your brain doesn't have enough desire to want to know about, not that you can't, but it's like, why? I don't even want to know, right?
Well, and the money thing, so I just think of it as bigger. Like, when you were talking about, okay, only 2% of venture capitalists of women get money. Okay, so the way that, what I think of when you're saying that is I think of the world of activism. Okay, so in the world of activism, in levels, I am the white man. Okay, like, one of the reasons why I remember you, Amy, beyond all of the freaking conventions that I go to, right? Is because, number one, I will never forget you speaking and running this unbelievable thing with your little baby who was like 4 minutes old, watching her mother in the front row. But also, I don't remember what you were doing other than half of what you were doing was about women of color. And you were like saying things that most people don't say in convention centers. You were using your time to point towards the inequities for women of color. That is why I remember you. That is what. So in my world, in the world of activism, it's the same. My job is, it's like almost like a Robin Hood situation. Like, people will trust me with their money. Okay. And they will trust me because they've been trained to trust people like me. Okay. Because white supremacy and patriarchy trains people to trust a prettyish white woman with who's thin. Like, literally, that's what it comes down to.
Okay? I mean, it's true. And like, we need to acknowledge things like that. So thank you for putting that out there.
Yeah. So what Together Rising knows, not through our gut, but through like tons and tons of research of talking to communities on the ground who are underserved and who have been screwed by status quo, is that when you ask those communities over and over again, who is doing the work? Who has been there with you? Who is effective? Who is doing the good work that you trust in your communities? It's always, I'm telling you that I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say it's 90% small groups led by women of color.
Mm-hmm.
None of whom are getting funding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They are working with barely anything and doing 10 times more than most of the groups who are getting all the funding and who are on the screen and who are getting the money and blah, blah, blah. So it's just interesting to, when I think of money and funding, I'm like, yeah, let's work out our family finances and like, don't get appetizers. But like, I'm also just thinking like, how do we switch the whole freaking system?
That's good.
Right? Like, my job is to know what I know, which is like, I, through some hard work and through a lot of white privilege, have gained this platform where people trust me with millions of dollars. And so my job is to be a bridge between those people who are giving me the money and the people on the ground who are not getting the funds, right? So it's just like interesting in the conversation of 2%, but like, and yet we are still not the people who are most affected by those biases, right?
Yeah. No, you're right. And usually whenever I talk about the fact that 2% of VC funding goes to women, you have to say that's to white women. Right. Only 0.0001% of venture capital dollars last year went to Black women. That's statistically zero, right? That's right. Zero.
Right. So, and I know, I don't know the business world, but like the story you're telling me is exactly the same story that I see in the world of activism. And by the way, in the world of art.
Mm-hmm. Like
one of the best results of the Share the Mic initiative that we just did was talking to other Black women or women of color who are in my industry and saying, wait a minute, let's talk. What was your advance? Wait, what? Like, wait, what? So then there you have the sports thing recreated. So I, as a white woman, get this big advance. A woman who's equally talented, but who's a Black woman, gets a much smaller advance. And then because I've gotten the big advance, the publishers are pouring more and more and more into me because they have to make up for the investment that they put in me originally and are putting less and less behind her because they didn't put much. And so then I get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then what do they say? Well, of course you make more. You have a bigger demand. But that demand was created by the very system that then comes in later and says, sorry, it's demand.
Oh, it's just so painful. And you have to think about it in terms of systems, which I think is the way you're describing it, which is so powerful.
Wow, what a conversation. I can't wait for part two. And actually, it was even tricky for us to figure out where to end part one because it was like an endless conversation with two best friends. Well, we actually felt like we were best friends with them. I'm sure that they didn't feel that same
I really think they did. I mean, Glennon followed me on Instagram after. Hi, Glennon. So I'm so proud of that.
Yes. No, we adore them. And we're definitely already planning a trip to Naples so that we can stalk them there. I'm just kidding, Glennon and Abby, but we love you guys.
And if you love our show, please listen on iHeartMedia or wherever you listen to podcasts. And please subscribe and follow us across the internet at www.whatsherstorypodcast.com. You do not want to miss part two of our conversation with Glennon and Abby. We will cover two topics dear to my heart, parenting and pay equity.
A huge thank you to our podcast production team at Large Media, L-A-R-J Media, as well as our sound engineer, Lou Burns, and our podcast associate producer, Emma Hard. This podcast is powered by Sam's company, Park Place Payments, and Amy's company, The Riveter. To learn more about Park Place Payments, visit parkplacepayments.com. To learn more about The Riveter, visit theriveter.co.